Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, some call it a post-truth society. With increased media consolidation, fake news, and plummeting trust in media, what needs to be done? But first, how propaganda works, particularly in democratic settings. With us is Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University, and the author of three books, Knowledge and Practical Interests, Know-How, and How Propaganda Works. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Jason Stanley. It's great to have you here. Your new book, How Propaganda Works, you do a real philosophical look at this and a bit of a historic look, especially through modern history. Let's look at your definition of propaganda. How are you defining it in this new book?
So I go through different definitions of propaganda in the second chapter, and I argue that the classical definitions in terms of bias and cherry picking are too general, because virtually everything counts as propaganda. I mean, each word shades things in a certain way. So if I call someone a professor, that will raise certain connotations in the hearer's mind, and hence bias the discourse. So almost every word has that kind of feature where it brings with it connotations that slightly slant the discourse. They don't make the discourse non-factual or inventing reality. They just sort of bias it slightly. If somebody says, professor, this professor said, then if they're talking to one kind of audience, that might give that source a very negative casting. And another audience, it might give that source a positive casting. But that's extraneous to the information being delivered. So I think that propaganda as speech that biases a conversation is too general. So I focus on a narrower characterization. I have two categories of propaganda. One I call supporting propaganda. And supporting propaganda is the kind of propaganda we find most characteristically in authoritarian societies. And unsurprisingly, you find authoritarians such as Goebbels or Hitler, when they describe propaganda, focusing on supporting propaganda. Supporting propaganda is propaganda that shuts off rational thought. It overwhelms rational thought with, as Klemperer calls them, emotions detached from their ideas. The idea here is not to draw a distinction between rationality and emotion. Emotions can be perfectly rational. It's perfectly rational to be fearful at certain times in history. It's perfectly rational to be fearful when you see a snake or something like that. Those are rational emotions. But supporting propaganda takes sort of accentuates emotions and causes the audience to cease reflecting upon the arguments provided. And as Klemperer says, and Goebbels, of authoritarian National Socialist propaganda, the goal is to fuse the audience into one emotion. And so that's supporting propaganda. Now, I focus less on the mechanisms of supporting propaganda in my book, because when I did write my book, I was assuming that many societies, including my own, had at least an attachment to liberal democratic ideals. So I focused mainly on what I call undermining propaganda. And undermining propaganda is an argument that employs an ideal in the service of a goal that undermines that ideal. So undermining propaganda only works if there's some ideology there that the hearers have, the desired target audience has, that enables them to not see the tension between the ideal and the goal. So, for example, suppose you thought that immigrants weren't really fit to be fellow citizens. Then you might think that measures used to harshly treat them were in line with humanism and justice, because you have an ideology, an anti-immigrant ideology, that leads you to think that the native-born are the real humans, and immigrants are somehow deficient. And so that ideology would allow a politician to be harshly xenophobic, but using the language of humanity and justice, because the target audience would have an ideology that prevented them from seeing that there was a tension between xenophobia and humanism.
Now, how does propaganda in a liberal democratic state differ from, say, propaganda in a more authoritarian, totalitarian state?
Excellent and very prescient question right now. As I say in my book, the difficulty there's sort of reverse difficulties. In an authoritarian state, the problem with propaganda is that people don't believe it. People don't believe when the leaders say things, people don't believe that they're going to go through on what they say because they say it's just propaganda. And you find this repeatedly throughout the literature on authoritarianism. Viktor Klemperer, in The Language of the Third Reich, has a whole chapter on this where he talks about how no one would believe that Hitler was really anti-Semitic. And my grandmother wrote one of the first Holocaust memoirs in the English language called The Unforgotten, which is a very important book to read right now, sadly out of print. And she talks again and again about this. She didn't leave Germany until August 1939. And she talks about a kind of refusal to believe that National Socialists were serious. And there was a period in time in Nazi Germany when there were parties, where my grandmother speaks of this, where she's at parties with Gestapo officers and SS officers who are like, well, we don't mean you. Come on. So in authoritarian societies, people just dismiss what's said. In liberal democratic societies, people don't believe there's propaganda. So they don't believe leaders can be lying or misleading. And so what I think you're seeing now is a blurring together, you sort of, as people employ authoritarian tactics in liberal democratic society, you're finding people saying, oh, come on, that's just propaganda. Whereas earlier they would have either said, oh, they're wrong, or they must know something. The propaganda of liberal democratic societies is that there's no propaganda. And what happens in authoritarian societies is that people too willingly dismiss it as mere propaganda. And most importantly, in authoritarian propaganda, you invent reality. And I don't really discuss this in my book, and I've tried to make up for it in my subsequent newspaper articles. But in an authoritarian society, the authoritarian leader demonstrates their power by creating reality. In an authoritarian society, the main principle is power. In a liberal democratic society, the main principles are equal respect and truth, which work together. So in an authoritarian society, what happens is that the leader wants to strengthen certain ideologies. So the leader demonstrates the leader's power by simply strengthening, making up reality to strengthen the flawed ideologies people already have. So they might say, there's a wave of violent crime. Or they might say, immigration poses a fundamental threat to our freedoms. Or they might give example, they might invent the reality that will lead people to strengthen the ideology that they're already susceptible to. So if in the United States election, we saw repeated claims that American cities were in flames and there was the highest crime rates ever, even though we're close to historic lows in crime. And that was an invention of reality to strengthen an ideology. And in authoritarian societies, people like power. People admire powerful leaders. So a leader demonstrates their power by inventing reality. In a liberal democratic society, there are strong norms to punish anyone who clearly violates, who says false things. And you know that liberal democratic values are crumbling when you see politicians being rewarded for inventing reality rather than being punished.
This is partly why you argue that propaganda threatens liberal democracies.
Yes, propaganda is a terrible threat to liberal democracies, but it can also be what's required to help liberal democracies. Propaganda can be used as a weapon to restore democratic ideals. For example, it can be directed against bad ideals. And this is what I discuss in my book under the label of civic rhetoric. Civic rhetoric, I'm very much devoted to the ideals of liberty and equality, and I might try to restore those goals, as Du Bois argues in his 1926 paper, Criteria of Negro Art. I might restore those ideals by focusing on flawed ideals and showing how they're in tension with freedom and equality. So Du Bois calls for artists to appeal to white audiences with negative images, with the sort of images, dehumanizing images of Black American citizens as mere dancers, people who dance and joke. But then within that paradigm, draw them into the theater that way, but then explode those negative ideals, undermine those negative ideals by showing the humanity of some of our fellow citizens who have been unfairly caricatured. And you can see this happening in the early 1990s with rap and hip hop. That was supposed to, there was a crisis of mass incarceration. There was a crisis of over-policing, a lack of empathy. And you had American citizens, descendants of enslaved Americans, producing music that was attempting to show that people in the situation were human, and they were in fact being subjugated by these harsh, punitive ideologies. But they drew listeners in by, quote unquote, glorifying violence.
One of the things about this particular issue that you wrote about in the preface of the book, when you were talking about mass incarceration, what struck me was your discussion about how this robs potential, the ideology of this, the propaganda of this, the false beliefs about this. Can you elaborate on that a bit, on the human potential aspect of this?
For the case of mass incarceration?
Sure. And if you want to connect that to the wider structures of society.
Yeah, I mean, I'm deeply influenced. I stand on the shoulders of feminist theorists and Black American theorists whose work I employ, and particularly scholars of American mass incarceration. So I'm teaching, for example, Elizabeth Hinton's book, From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, to the War on Drugs, which is an account of the Nixon administration's propaganda that created a system that incarcerates somewhere between 2.2 million and 2.5 million people in its prisons, both federal, state, and local. Our incarceration rate is 752 per 100,000, which dwarfs any other nations in the world. Russia is second at 500 some out of 100,000. And the next liberal democracy is the UK at 150 or 149 per 100,000. So our incarceration rate is staggeringly high. And we have eight times the rate that we did in 1973. In 1973, we had 300,000 people in prison, jail, or federal prison. Now we have between 2 and 2.5 million and 8 million people on probation or parole, which is brutal in the United States. It prevents you from getting jobs, et cetera. So what happened? So what happened was in the 1960s, you had the civil rights movement. And the civil rights movement involved a lot of protests. And some of that protest turned violent, like in Detroit, famously. And what Nixon did when he took office is he changed the narrative from social justice and equal rights to law and order. And he repainted and redescribed the protests as riots. So, and we find the same thing happening today, by the way. If you look at Fox News and their descriptions of what happened in Baltimore, a city that was racked by protests over police malfeasance, police misconduct. You see, Fox News described the protests as riots, used the word riot 7 words out of 1,000 in its reports about Baltimore. And they used protest less than 3 words out of 1,000. CNN was more even-handed. They used the word riot just under 4 words per 100 per 1,000 and the word protest just over 3 words per 1,000 in describing Baltimore. And MSNBC used protest slightly more than riot in describing what was happening in Baltimore. This is why I said that you can't define propaganda as, you know, skewed discourse, because each word carries this way of skewing reality. I mean, there were people and they were gathering and they were doing things, but how you describe it is going to really affect the uptake. So Nixon redescribed what was happening, not as protests, but as riots, and then shifted the nation's attention from the ideals of equality and social justice to law and order. And then he applied law and order in a way that undermined law and order, because he applied it unequally, where it fell particularly harshly on Black Americans and political dissidents. This year, his statement, Elizabeth Hinton, I think, discovered this. I'm not sure who discovered this, but it was revealed in the past year that Nixon said, we're going to have a war on drugs and we'll target marijuana to get the hippies and we'll target heroin to get the blacks. So it was explicitly, and then we'll humiliate them on national television over and over again. So Abby Hoffman was caught up in this. And so what happened is you shifted the nation's attention from one set of ideals to another. And you could do this with, you could shift. And we've seen this happen with the Syrian refugee crisis. At first, social justice saved these refugees, and then it was shifted to, danger, terrorism, law and order, protect us. So then what happens when you shift the ideals, then you can filter them through a flawed ideology. So that you can see that the war on drugs was a flawed filtered through a flawed racist ideology. You can see this from the differential reaction to the opiate and heroin crisis devastating white communities today, which is dealt with by empathy, versus the early 70s reaction to Black heroin usage, which was where it was only punitive and there was no empathy at all. So Americans had in the early 70s and today, have a flawed racist ideology. So when you have law and order there centered, and they think of, say, drug use by Black fellow citizens, their reaction is punitive. But when they think of drug use by white fellow citizens, their reaction is empathetic. So mass incarceration is law and order differentially applied through flawed ideology, racial ideologies. But that undermines law and order, democratic law and order, because at the very core of democratic law and order is fairness and impartiality. And so we should have the same reaction to a 16-year-old white heroin user and a 16-year-old Black heroin user. And we see quite clearly from American history that our government does not have the same reaction. We can see that Nixon, when he was calling for law and order in the face of these protests, and when he was calling for law and order in the face of a drug crisis, was relying on the flawed racist ideology. And that's why he said, we're going to have a war on drugs to target the Blacks.
Would you say that inequality feeds propaganda, or that propaganda is creating inequality, or is this a mutual system?
It's a mutual system. The flawed ideology arises from inequality, because those who benefit from inequality have a legitimation myth. They have to tell themselves that they deserve their place. They deserve it. And so when it's so clear that they don't deserve it, say birth position, you do nothing to deserve your own birth position. So those who are born into a privileged birth position, whether by gender, by sexual orientation, by race, by citizenship status, tend to think that they deserve it. And so when there's inequality, that gives rise to this flawed ideology that protects you from having to face your own complicity in structural injustice. And then that allows propaganda to flourish, because a flawed ideology is what prevents you from recognizing the inconsistency between the ideal and the goal. What could explain the radically differential reaction Americans have to white heroin use versus Black heroin use, other than a very different conception of those whom they should regard as equals? So when you have a flawed ideology, a legitimation, when you have inequality, unless you want to face your own complicity, which requires action and sacrifice, you're going to have a legitimation myth. And that legitimation myth is there and is in place to prevent you from seeing certain aspects of social reality. For example, that you don't deserve where you are, that you inherited it. So that has to be in place. And hey, it's your social identity to occupy that level to reap the benefits of inequality, because most of your friends will be in similar positions. So your social identity will be tied to that legitimation myth, and that will allow propaganda that feeds into your own legitimation myth, your own flawed ideology, to be effective.
It seems also that in order to even challenge your beliefs or that ideology that you're talking about, you would have to have information that would counter it. And, you know, people are not always looking around for that type of information that then they would have to question, well, why is it this way?
Right. So information bubbles. So what a flawed ideology does is it enables you, even when confronted with the information, to disregard it. So, for example, certain politicians have successfully portrayed universities as giving, as, you know, the sources of falsehood, and climate scientists as the purveyors of flawed ideology. So people discount the information that they're given from those sources. But if you don't even have access to the sources, if you only get information from venues that strengthen your own flawed ideologies or your own ideologies, you know, then matters are unfortunately quite hopeless.
There's been quite a bit of research among psychologists and political psychologists and such about a couple of phenomena here. One is that when you do get information that is counter to what you really believe, that there is a cognitive dissonance that makes it very uncomfortable to listen to. And I think that is one factor here. How do you suggest we deal with something like that?
It's, well, what to do is always the hardest. And I take myself as a chronicler of what is, but we now have to shift into what to do. You have a cognitive dissonance because, you know, all theories of ideology must explain the facts to which you're drawing our attention. We don't like to hear information that's inconsistent with our legitimation myths, that's inconsistent with the beliefs that form our ideology. So they're very uncomfortable. We seek alternative explanations. So one thing that could be done is diversifying our friend groups so that people are reached. Unfortunately, this strategy is tricky because it's been used to argue that we should have more people involved who have really problematic ideologies. So, and it's true, it would be good to have a sense of what undergirds someone who, say, hates my people, Jewish people, you know, to understand where they're coming from. But I do think, you know, it's important to somehow, I don't think we can approach the question about what to do without being clear that some views are true and some are not true. And there are various ways to find out what's true, and the scientific method is one, and empirical research. I mean, what happens in the university? I mean, I'm very, you know, methods and practices of investigating the world are parts of our ideologies. And you and I believe in the methods and practices of the Enlightenment or something like that, what happens in universities. And, you know, the problem we now face is that there are people who challenge those methods. They say, no, science is ideological. And so how do you address that? How do you address that without having some societal decision that these methods, for instance, scientific methods, are to be trusted? I'm not sure you can overcome that. We just have to recognize that there are facts out there. And when we give up on that, we're sunk. And then we need to discuss, you know, whether the methodology used by, say, climate science is a good way to find out what the facts are. And you look at the people who disparage climate science, and they have strong financial interests in so doing. And you can sort of point that out, maybe. But I don't know if there's any way. One has to have truth as a value, and there has to be intersubjective agreement on basic methods for discovering the truth. And what I'm concerned about now is that that ground has been undermined.
On a much lesser scale, even in the academy itself, there can be problems that we are ourselves blind to. And you point that out rightfully in your preface of your book.
Yes. I mean, the academy is what is what justified mass incarceration. So absolutely right. Yeah. Often what happens is the societal ideologies get through to the academy and then are, as it were, whitewashed, you know, are, and then handed back to societies for society as a legitimation of their legitimation. So this is what happened with mass incarceration when John DiIulio, a professor at Princeton University, came up with super predator theory with Vincent Fox of Northeastern. And so then they, you know, deeply affected the 1990s, the criminal justice debate. He said there's a generation of super predators growing up, and he predicted a fivefold increase in violent crime. And so between 1995 and 2000, violent crime dropped precipitously in the United States between 1995 and 2000. So you could say by the standards of the academy, those errors get found out. But you're absolutely right that statistics, we're not God. We're not even super, we're not even, you know, we have a limited amount of time to find things out, even via scientific research. So we certain hypotheses we have to discard. Certain hypotheses are going to seem more sensible to us. And because we have just a limit, we're only on Earth for 80 years if we're lucky. You know, we have a limited time. We can't investigate every possibility. It's going to be our pre-existing ideologies that determine which hypotheses we find more likely. And so the university is going to be deeply affected by the external ideologies of society because we can't investigate every possibility. We only have time on this earth and within the confines of a junior faculty career to get tenure. You only have a few years. So you have to look at hypotheses that will maximize your chances of getting tenure, maximizes your chances of getting research support, which means if your government happens to be xenophobic, or as happened in the early 1990s with drug policy, as the Columbia neuroscientist Carl Hart has documented in his book, High Price, research money went to those who said that drugs are really, really, really bad. And what happened is that people produced experiments where they gave mice like an amount of cocaine that would kill a human. And they said, look, cocaine is bad for you. Yeah. Or they had this experiment where they, you know, the famous experiment where they put cocaine and, you know, I'm not recommending the use of cocaine by any means. But nevertheless, you know, there was a tremendous amount of drug propaganda that Carl Hart documents presented under the guise of science. Famous experiment, you put a mouse in a cage and you give them the choice of taking cocaine or eating food. And the mice decide each time to take the cocaine rather than the food, and they die. So this was used in policy. And then someone else did an experiment where they added a running wheel to the cage. And what they found is that the mice did not die and often ate the food because they would run on the running wheel and weren't as bored. So in the first experiment, the mice were literally bored to death. So absolutely right. The incentive structure changes radically. The incentive structure for the university is a function of the greater society. And that means that the clear distinction I wanted to draw can't be drawn.
Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle, Jason Stanley.
Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful interview.
Jason Stanley is professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of three books, Knowledge and Practical Interests, Know-How, and How Propaganda Works. When we come back, with increased media consolidation, fake news, and plummeting trust in media, what needs to be done? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Some call it a post-truth society. With increased media consolidation, fake news, and plummeting trust in media, what needs to be done to solve our epistemological crisis? With us are two experts. Robert Entman is professor of media and public affairs at George Washington University. His latest book is called Scandal and Silence, Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct. Victor Picard also joins us. He's a professor of communication at Annenberg at the University of Pennsylvania. His latest book is called Media Activism in the Digital Age. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you both back with us. Really important times for both of your areas of study, particularly now with media. I think we are in what, Victor, you have called a misinformation age, or you said society, but I would say misinformation age. I wonder if we should start, Victor, with your analysis of how we got here.
Sure. I think this situation we're in right now, which, as you noted, I characterize as a misinformation society, has happened gradually. There certainly have been historical reasons that led us to this current predicament. But I think what happened and why we're talking about it more now is that the election of Donald Trump brought into focus a number of structural pathologies in our media system. I think we're just now, as a society, beginning to reckon with some of these systemic problems, whether we're talking about the proliferation of so-called fake news or misinformation, as well as the tendencies for our mainstream news media system to sensationalize politics and important policy issues. So I think if there is a silver lining, right now, at least more people are aware of these problems, and we're beginning to talk about potential structural ways to fix these problems.
You said it happened gradually, but your work suggests that there were a few major things that happened that led us down this path. What would you say those major things are?
Sure. I would pinpoint to two general areas. I would point out that the what's sometimes referred to as the journalism crisis is a worsening problem where we are losing actual public service journalism. So in other words, there are fewer reporters covering important issues, things like elections and policy problems. So that's a supply problem where the news content is gradually being diminished. Then we also have more of an infrastructure problem where increasingly the actual pipes and channels and media flows are being controlled by fewer and fewer corporations. So this is a monopoly problem that, again, if I were to be cautiously optimistic, I think we're beginning to address this, at least at the discursive level. At least we're beginning to talk about this problem where media monopolies have too much power in society.
Bob Entman, do you agree with this assessment?
Well, I guess I'd point out in terms of what Victor was talking about is change factors, that it's not just change in technology or change in markets, it's also a change in policy that's driven this. So the deregulation of the media, the almost complete abandonment of antitrust policy until, ironically, recently, the Trump administration decided specifically to look into the acquisition of CNN is one factor. I also think, yes, we're beginning to talk about the problem of control, but the self-reinforcing power system now, where smaller and smaller numbers of people and corporations together can influence the political process, makes it hard to do more than talk. And it remains to be seen whether the pressure from below is going to be responded to in any way by the current government. It's possible with the change in government, we might see some differences. But I think we're talking about some structural changes actually in the power, the way power flows, not just the way information flows.
So to me, it seems there are bigger problems in which the economic model fits into. I mean, I think we have bigger existential problems right now beyond the economic ownership. Part of this is, of course, I mean, there's a new trend of A, billionaires buying their own publications, which is counter to what we have historically seen. But there's also this proliferation of truly fake news. And I think combined with what we have been doing as media scholars in rightfully criticizing the economic model and rightfully criticizing the coverage of things, I fear that we have given a platform to somebody like Donald Trump to then be able to say it's all fake news whenever there's accuracy. Victor Picard, what do you think?
I do agree that the gradual weakening of our news media institutions have left them vulnerable to these kinds of exploitation. And to be a little more specific, I think the commercial imperatives that have been driving our news media for so long, but as they face economic crisis, in some ways, these pressures have even worsened, has led them to sensationalize, has led them to gradually lose the public's trust. And it has become easier for opportunists like Donald Trump to step in and dismiss professional news media as being fake news. So that is one problem. And I think you're also identifying another problem, that as these news organizations become weakened and devalued economically, they're easy pickings for politicos who have particular agendas to buy them up. And we're seeing that with newspapers, but we're also seeing that with further media conglomeration and media concentration. Exhibit A I would point out would be the rise of Sinclair Broadcast Group. They are in the process of merging with Tribune and will soon, if it goes through, and everyone assumes that it will, they'll be reaching over 70% of American households. So these are just a couple of examples where, yes, I think the economic crisis have left news organizations vulnerable to these political opportunistic problems. And I agree with Bob. It's going to take policy intervention to change this.
Bob Entman, what about the handing of the platform to somebody like Donald Trump to then devalue what might be truly real as fake news? Have we contributed to that platform that he has?
Well, in the sense that the mainstream media, which, as Victor says, have suffered economic losses and confidence losses, they're now in a position where I think you have two real problems. One is the false equivalence, so that you had reporting during the 2016 campaign in which Trump's scandals were treated as actually less serious than Clinton's for a variety of technical reasons. But this equivalence traces to this marginalization, the fear of the mainstream media of these economic and trust issues. So you've got a weakness that has led them to abandon opportunities to correct a lot of these misimpressions from fake news. And actually, they could be increasing their own legitimacy if they did more reporting on the facts. Let me take a specific example. You turn CNN on at almost any hour, what they will be talking about is Donald Trump. And what they'll be talking about is the politics around Donald Trump and maybe the Russia scandal a little bit. But they won't be talking about very much about the policy issues, the policies that Donald Trump is making, the many forms of corruption that are on a pretty clear view if you discuss it and point it out. And these are things that would make people, I think, both less susceptible to Trump's propaganda, which I think is very skillful. And I think he deserves actually more credit for being a skilled communicator than he gets. But it would delegitimize some of that and would give people more information on which to criticize and reject fake news.
I'm glad you brought up the scandal, because we have seen quite a bit of coverage on money laundering, what appears to be obstruction of justice, what appears to be a conspiracy. And you started to assess how the media have been covering these scandals. And it sounded like you gave them like a D. What would you say?
Well, I think they're doing a better job now than they did during the election campaign. So if you're talking about empowering Trump, you're really talking about his ability to manipulate the mainstream media as well as the digital media during the campaign to pay so much attention to Hillary Clinton's email so-called scandal and to distract attention from investigating his own. This combines, I should say, with another important factor in all of these crises, which is the change in the nature of our party system. The media rely heavily on the two parties and competition between the two parties. If one of those parties begins to abandon the norms that have governed the political process, you're really rendering the media less able to provide balanced coverage. An example of this abandoning the norm is the, and this is not about Donald Trump simply, but it's about things like the Republican National Committee and other prominent Republicans accepting Roy Moore as and supporting Roy Moore as a candidate. This is an illustration of their leaving behind norms that used to govern political discourse and then enabled us to have a more balanced discussion of reality.
One of the other things that you've talked about, Bob Entman, and looking at media's coverage of important scandals versus not so important scandals or things that might not even really rise to the level of scandal, you've also talked about cover-up and using attacks on the media to essentially defend oneself. It seems like Donald Trump is doing that as well to discredit what might be true in a cover-up of the scandal. Are you analyzing this at this point, too?
Yeah, well, I am analyzing particularly the campaign. But I guess I'd also point out that I think the media are pretty much doing quite a bit about the Trump scandals. However, what we have is a Congress that is really not interested in pursuing these. The whole story of Watergate and the whole enormous myth around Watergate and the great way that the system triumphed by getting rid of Nixon and his corruption was rooted in a system in which both Republicans and Democrats actually wanted to get to the bottom of the situation. We don't have that now. We don't have, for example, major hearings for television to be covering. And in the absence of that, you have a very different situation and the possibility that the cover-up could succeed, at least for a very long time. I think it's important for Americans and others around the world to recognize we're in a new political world, not just because of the media factors that Victor talked about, but these political system factors.
So then, given the low trust in media and in government, and this, I guess The Economist called it a post-truth society, or what Victor is calling a misinformation society, and all of the other factors coming into this, the fake news sites, the billionaires buying up the media, net neutrality and what's happening to that, is the toothpaste out of the tube, or is this fixable? Victor Picard?
Well, I haven't given up hope that the problem is fixable, or at least we can make it less of a problem. And I think the first step will be, again, to raise awareness around some of these issues and get people to think beyond the, you know, many of the factors that Bob was just discussing are kind of symptomatic characteristics in our news media. They're being driven by these commercial values. I mean, for example, the fact that they're so fixated on Donald Trump's latest tweet, I mean, that's irresistible for advertising-driven news media. That spikes. That's inherently controversial. It drives ratings. And that's one of the reasons why Donald Trump is so ubiquitous in our news media. So I think if we start connecting these dots and show the structural reasons behind this kind of media content, we can begin to imagine a different kind of media system And that's one where I think it needs to be less reliant on these market-based mechanisms. We have to start envisioning a more public-oriented media system, whether we're talking about protecting net neutrality or having a fully funded public media system. I think that's where the debate needs to go.
Well, I would generally agree with you. And the reason I asked if the toothpaste is out of the tube is because I don't see that happening in the U.S. And I see other countries following on the heels of the U.S. with this so-called liberalization of media, where even the BBC is struggling to, you know, continue its old path of this public service kind of broadcasting. And then you add to that all of the discrediting sites. The alt-right is creating their own web. We're speaking all different languages. We don't agree on basic realities. The fundamental purveyor of truth, which is science and scholarship, is getting thoroughly shredded in those other spheres. So, you know, I'm acting a little bit alarmist, perhaps, but I see this as a major existential crisis. Bob Entman, what do you think?
Well, when I look around the world, I do see it as a crisis. I do see liberal democratic institutions under assault by a lot of these forces we've talked about, as well as by opportunistic politicians and parties. I don't know whether to say I'm optimistic. I don't think that's right. But I also think, first of all, that Victor is absolutely right that there needs to be discussion of real public media and the value of that to democracy, the indispensable nature of that. But second of all, that there is hope in using the web and digital technologies to organize people, get people out to vote, to inform them to some degree. And we do see in the Alabama election result that it is possible. We also saw in Bernie Sanders' campaign the use of the internet to organize and also to raise money that allowed him to mount a campaign that was pretty much the equal of Hillary Clinton's in financing. This is a very important lesson and model for going forward for future political organizing. So there are some counter forces here.
Really important points, Bob Entman. So, Victor Picard, let's go back to you. One of the things that you've actually been writing about, too, is net neutrality. Walk us through what's at stake.
Yes. Well, I think it's very apt to turn to net neutrality, especially after Bob listed, I think, correctly, all of these democratic potentials that the internet holds, especially for activists and dissident groups and journalists as well. But we lose some of that democratic potential if we are to lose net neutrality protections. Net neutrality sounds very wonky and technical, but it's a very simple safeguard for the internet, which basically ensures that your internet service provider cannot censor political speech or just general expression online, that your internet service provider, whether it's Comcast or Verizon, cannot slow down or block online content, cannot create a tiered internet. And we've taken this for granted for many years. But if we were to lose net neutrality, it would radically change the basic logic of the internet. The struggle for net neutrality will not end at that moment. And shortly thereafter, it's expected to go to the courts, where I actually think activists have a good chance of winning it back. I think this decision will likely be viewed by the courts as being arbitrary and capricious, which means that a regulatory agency cannot simply switch a rule every time a new administration comes into power. So I think there's reason that we may still prevail, but it's going to take a lot of struggle from below as well as victory in the courts.
The other thing I'm really interested in hearing your take on, both of you, pertains to this idea of media literacy. Very sophisticated people, educated people are really distrusting fundamental facts because they have come from what we would call traditional media. What do you do to increase media literacy and the ability to discern the fake from the real in a general population? Victor, why don't you start?
Sure. I think whenever we talk about media literacy, there's often an assumption that this should be part of our educational curriculum, that it's something that we should be teaching in our schools. And I certainly agree with that. I also would go further to say that, and this speaks against some of the cynicism that I think rightfully is seeping into our conversation about the future of journalism. But right now, there is this newfound appreciation for the Fourth Estate. Many people are seeing it as an essential defense against everything from fake news to fascism. So I do think we are in an opportune moment to expand our media literacy efforts. And I think part of this, not to repeat myself, but I think part of this is to understand some of these structural relationships behind the news in order to understand why news covers issues in a particular way.
Bob Entman.
Well, absolutely, that the literacy, analytical thinking, appropriate skepticism without total distrust of science and scholarship and real journalism. All of these are things that we would like people to understand and look out for. We do have, unfortunately, elites in the United States, and I don't know about elsewhere, attacking public education and trying to weaken public education. We have a tax bill in which the graduate students of the United States are facing enormous increases in the cost of their education, which means teachers and professors are being attacked. So there are efforts to kind of undermine literacy of all forms. And I think that needs to be more on the table, that we really ought to be discussing how public education and education generally are under assault from a large component of the leaders of our society. And, you know, if education's weakened, it's going to be harder to inculcate media literacy.
So just to bring a little cynicism back, Victor Picard, sorry. And what Bob Entman just talked about in terms of the what the Republicans have put forward on the tax bill, we've talked about the structural problems. We've said, look, we need a policy change. I don't see that happening with the current government. I didn't see it happening with a previous government or several previous ones before. What I'm wondering is, not saying that this can't change, but the current body in power thrives on this lack of education and the lack of literacy. Their power is based on this. So why would they give up any of it? And we are relying on grassroots to potentially challenge that. But I see a sort of clinging to power through these. Am I being conspiratorial?
I think you're being skeptical in a very healthy way. I think there is a healthy form of cynicism here at work. But I would also say that it is precisely during these dark political moments that we need to be thinking ahead. We need to be envisioning the kind of media system that we would want to have. What is our ideal vision for this? And right now, much of that project, you're absolutely right, is not something that we can take. We certainly wouldn't want the Trump administration to suddenly expand a kind of state media apparatus. On the other hand, I do think there are things that we could be doing at the local level. We could be supporting our local news organizations, even as individuals, but also as through community groups. We could be trying to create community-owned and municipal-owned and operated broadband networks. There are various local initiatives that are trying to take proceeds from spectrum auctions and fund local public service journalism initiatives. So there are things that we can be doing, but I think most important, we need to be thinking for the long term, for post-Trump America, which I do think will happen someday.
Bob Entman, last word.
Yeah, I think there are potential powerful counter reactions to what's happening now, and that all hope is not lost, as illustrated by what happened in Alabama. have organizations like ProPublica that are doing terrific investigative work, and there's ways to get that material out through social media that didn't exist before. I like Victor's point about action at the local and state level. These are still places where ordinary citizens can have an impact on policy and things can change. I also think calling on a lot of the charitable organizations in the United States to turn a little, this may be controversial, turn a little of their attention away from the suffering in the rest of the world and come back home and spend some money on democracy and education right here in the United States.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us, Victor Picard and Robert Entman. Really a pleasure hosting you. I appreciate your thoughts and I appreciate your research, and I really appreciate you sharing them with us and our audience.
A pleasure.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you. Robert Entman is professor of media and public affairs at George Washington University. His latest book is called Scandal and Silence: Media Responses to Presidential Misconduct. Victor Picard, he's a professor of communication at Annenberg at the University of Pennsylvania. His latest book is called Media Activism in the Digital Age. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.